Last time we discussed the Schwarzschild metric. Minus, and I'll write it in this form. Okay, so what Schwarzschild showed is that that is a solution of the Einstein equation for any constant RS. And then as we discussed, the interpretation of RS, RS is called the Schwarzschild radius. Interpretation is that RS is 2gm over c squared, where m is the mass you would detect at infinity, at large distances, away from the black hole. So this solves R mu nu equals zero, the empty space Einstein equation. And I should say that except at R equals zero. It's just analogous to in electromagnetism when we work out the Coulomb field, right? You can't claim this solves the empty space Maxwell's equations at R equals zero because the solution is singular there. And so it's not clear what the differential equation means. And as we study that more, we discover that the singularity in the field corresponds to the presence of a charge, right? So this doesn't solve at R equals zero. And in fact, you should be skeptical whether it solves it at R equals RS too, because it's singular there as well. So the derivatives don't exist at R equals RS, because this function is badly behaved there. So you can be skeptical, you should be skeptical, about this Schwarzschild solution at, and we should be skeptical about R equals RS. Okay. As we're going to discuss, I hope, if we get to it this lecture, we're going to show that the problem at R equals RS is just a coordinate problem, and we can change coordinates and remove the problem completely. But in doing that, we're going to find some really amazing things about the solution. So we will find another universe in the solution. We will find, we hoped we would find a black hole. Actually, we'll find a white hole as well. Okay, so there are lots of things hiding behind this coordinate singularity. And I hope you'll be shocked and amazed. And I hope you will be disbelieving. And then, as Einstein said famously in a letter to a colleague when he discovered GR, he said, the theory is very surprising at first sight and very strange. But the more you think about it, the more compelling it becomes. And you should feel the same way about the, I think you will feel the same way about the resolution of this problem at RS. Okay, so first of all, let's do some relatively mundane things today, which is to review the experimental tests of general relativity. They were far from mundane at the time. But what they did is confirm some of the details. So they confirmed the differences between general relativity's predictions and those of Newtonian mechanics. And these differences are small, because as we've described, in the first approximation, GR is constructed to agree with Newton. Or maybe that's not really fair. There were enough clues, Newton plus Galileo, the fact that masses fell equally under gravity was a clue to GR. So certainly Newtonian mechanics was a very strong clue to GR. As I've emphasized, the amazing thing about Einstein's theory is it didn't introduce any new parameters. So it puts all of us theoretical physicists today to absolute shame, okay, and yet it gave new predictions, And that, so we're going to discuss the simplest of these now. And at the time, they really shocked and amazed people and quite rapidly convinced people that GR probably was correct. Although Einstein never got a Nobel Prize for GR. I don't know why. Okay, so most of the simple tests of GR actually just use the Schwarzschild metric. And the argument is that the sun is a mass. Outside the sun is roughly spherically symmetric, so outside the sun, the metric should be roughly Schwarzschild. Of course, the sun isn't exactly spherically symmetric. It has a dipole moment, it has a quadrupole moment, and there was some controversy about whether these the non-sphericity of the sun actually equally could explain phenomena just in Newton's gravity without GR. But in the tests of GR, we're going to use the sun, and we're going to assume it's spherically symmetric without full justification. So what we want to understand is the orbits of a massive particle. And actually, we're going to consider Mercury. That's a pretty massive particle around the sun. And it's obvious that gravity is stronger there. So if you're going to see any deviation from Newtonian mechanics, Mercury is the best bet. So what we're going to do is solve the geodesic equation. And determine the shape of the orbit. Okay, so as you're all familiar, Newtonian mechanics predicted elliptical orbits around the sun, and that was what confirmed the inverse square law, so that it just automatically gave elliptical orbits, which had already been measured by Brahe and modeled by Kepler and so on. So in GR, the orbits are not elliptical, okay? And the deviations from elliptical orbits are the first significant difference with Newtonian gravity. So now, we could solve the geodesic equation, but in GR, it's always important to find shortcuts. Okay, so, and it turns out that for spherical symmetry, there is enough symmetry that you can just use a shortcut. And you don't need to solve a geodesic equation. You could do it, but it's a waste of time. For spherical symmetry, and for a spherically symmetric, static metric, so that's another symmetry. Time is independent of time. There's enough symmetry. There is enough symmetry to get the orbit just from the condition that the four-velocity square is minus 1, from g mu nu u mu u nu equals minus 1. So that's a first order differential equation for the coordinate. Remember, u mu is dx mu d tau. Yep.
So yesterday we wrote down a general metric, which is spherically symmetric. That's the only thing we assumed.
Correct.
And then we derived that you can rewrite it in Schwarzschild.
Yes.
So a Schwarzschild metric.
Yes, using this equation. We use the Einstein equation.
Where exactly does the need for a static metric come in here?
When we solved the Einstein equation, we showed that the most general solution could be put in these coordinates where it is static. Okay, that's what we showed yesterday.
Yes.
Didn't assume anything. We assumed these equations.
Okay.
And we showed
anything about being static.
No.
No. So we showed the illusion here.
We showed this implies that. And this is static.
Yes.
So the metric I'm studying is static. I didn't assume it. It's a consequence of the Einstein equations and spherical symmetry. So what I'm saying here is for a spherically symmetric static metric, there's enough symmetry to get the orbit just from that condition. Okay, so there's a chain of arguments here. Okay, so let's just write down that. You see, the reason you can get away with just using this equation is when you have all this symmetry, there's lots of conserved quantities. Right, so because of time translation symmetry, I'm going to have a conserved energy. Because of rotational symmetry, I'm going to have a conserved angular momentum. Those two conservation laws are going to remove effectively two of the coordinates. One of them is rather, so we have four coordinates for the particle. We've got the two polar angles, and we've got time and radius. The one of the polar angles is kind of trivial because it's the the theta angle, and providing the orbit is in a plane, it's going to remain in the plane. And then the phi we're going to remove with angular momentum, and the t we're going to remove with energy, leaving us only with one coordinate. And if you've got one coordinate left, then one differential equation is enough to fix it. Okay. So when you have enough symmetry, you don't need to bother with the geodesic equation. It's all, by the way, the geodesic equation conserves this, right? So I think we showed earlier that d by dtor of g mu nu x dot nu equals 0 using the geodesic equation. OK, so the geodesic equation is completely compatible with this condition. So dot here is d by d tau, obviously. So let's just write that down. We have minus 1 minus rs over r t dot squared plus 1 minus rs over r inverse r dot squared plus r squared theta dot squared plus sine squared theta phi dot squared equals minus 1. Now, as I said, the theta angle is kind of trivial because we have spherical symmetry. And so it makes sense to consider an orbit which lies in the xy plane at theta equals pi over 2. And any such orbit is never going to get out of that plane. And so we just set, we can set theta equals pi over 2. And that immediately removes this term and sets this equal to 1. OK, so that's the first symmetry we use. So now we just have to solve this equation for three coordinates, phi, r, and t. And as I said, we're going to eliminate t and phi using energy and angular momentum. So what is the energy? Well, we just use Noether's theorem. Right, so the action was minus m integral square root g mu nu x dot mu. Well, let's call it x dx. Let's say it's dx mu d lambda, dx nu d lambda d lambda. That's the action, the length of the world line. And if I calculate the conserved energy, that comes from Noether's equation, where you simply take d Lagrangian d x naught dot. OK, and then by the Lagrangian equations, if the Lagrangian is independent of x naught, the Lagrangian equations look like this, d by dt, d dl dx naught dot, right? The variational equations. And if the Lagrangian's independent of x naught, then this guy is conserved, and that's the energy. So, and I should think about this as dx naught d lambda, okay? Because my action, the time parameter in the action is really this parameter lambda. And this will turn out to be g mu nu, I guess there's an m outside there, g mu 0 x d x 0 d tau. Okay, so this quantity is a conserved quantity. And likewise, the angular momentum is m g, sorry, what am I doing here? G 0, 0.
Isn't it supposed to be to d lambda instead of d tau?
No, it's d tau. When you differentiate this with the velocity, you get the inverse square root. We did this before. So in the numerator, you get g mu nu dx 0 d lambda. And then you get, there's a factor of 2 because there are two of these factors, right? And then in the denominator, you get square root of minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. And then you have the d tor equals d lambda square root minus g mu nu. OK. So when I take the Lagrangian derivative, this is really dx. Well, in this case, lambda is the time. So it's dx 0 d lambda, right? This is the variational equation. And so this is equal to minus g mu nu dx 0 d tau.
Mm-hmm. Do your other equations say d dt?
They say d by d lambda, thank you. For if lambda is the time, okay. Yeah. That's the Euler-Lagrange equation, okay, for this action. So you can easily check this is conserved. The general formula is that let me not try to be too general, but the Noether. This is what you get from Noether. Just apply the Noether argument, and what you get is the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the coordinate x naught. If the action has a symmetry under x naught goes to x naught plus constant, this quantity is conserved. And likewise, the angular momentum, you would get g phi. I should really write this. G mu zero, let me just do this a little bit more carefully. If I vary the action, I'm varying it with respect to dx zero d lambda, right? So one of these indices is zero, and the other one is nu. And so the constant, I wrote it the wrong way. It's like this. Yeah, I'm just differentiating this with respect to dx naught d lambda, right? And so that means I take out that factor, and the coefficient is g0 nu dx mu d tor. And likewise here, the angular momentum, actually we're going to call it j, would be m times g phi mu dx mu d tor. But of course, g is diagonal. So all I get is g 0, 0, which is this guy, minus 1 minus, sorry, actually what I get is minus 1 minus RS over R dx 0 d tau. So that's the energy with a factor of m. And the angular momentum, similarly, is plus g phi phi is the only non-zero component. G phi phi is this coefficient. So m r squared sine squared theta, which we're going to set equal to 1 because theta is pi over 2 times d phi d tau. Okay, so what this tells us is that this quantity is a constant, and this quantity is a constant, and so I can eliminate the constants from here. Now, let me just divide by m to make this I don't want the m's lying around. They will complicate the formula. So what should I do? Yeah, let's call it e hat or something. Let e hat equals e over m, and j hat equals j over m. And then I'm going to write it all in terms of e hat and j hat. So what I now have is... So minus e hat squared. I'll drop the hats. Okay. My usual trick. I'll change the new variable and drop the hats. Minus e squared over 1 minus rs over r plus r dot squared over 1 minus rs over r plus j squared over r squared equals minus 1. Okay, where did I get that from? I just substituted x naught is t. We've taken c equals 1, so x naught is t. So dt dtor is e, or e hat, over this factor. So square it, we get this factor in the denominator. This term is just this term, and this term I phi dot is j over r squared. So I just get j squared over r squared in that term. So all of that is minus 1. OK, and voila, we have a first order differential equation for r. And that completely determines the radial motion. So how do we organize it? Let's take this equation and try to interpret it as a particle moving in a potential. So multiply it by 1 minus rs over r. And what we get is r dot squared. And then we have plus j squared times 1 over r squared 1. Let me write out the separate terms. 1 over r squared minus rs over r cubed. Okay, I'm just multiplying through by 1 minus rs over r. And then we have minus, then I'll pull the e squared over here, equals e squared minus 1, which is a constant. So indeed, that looks like a particle moving in a potential. This is the kinetic energy. This is the potential energy. And the sum of the two is a constant. So you can use all your intuition from classical mechanics to see what the solution looks like. So let's call this guy V of R. And let's graph it. So I've left out a term. Because when I multiply through by 1 minus rs over r, of course, I get this minus 1. And I also get a plus rs over r. And I'll pull that onto the left-hand side. OK? And it's easy to see which terms reproduce Newton. I seem to have a minus sign wrong. Let's see, how did that happen? Minus minus is plus, so sorry, that should be a minus. So Newton, of course, comes from this term, and this term. When I do Newtonian mechanics, I've got r dot squared minus gm over r. Actually, I have a half r dot squared minus gm over r plus the centrifugal barrier, right? And so these three are Newton. These three terms are just Newton, and this term is the Einstein's correction. And you can see it's small if the radius you're talking about is much bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, right? Then this term, relative to this term, it's down by RS over R. So providing RS is smaller than the radius of the orbit, this term is small. So it's down by RS over R. Now for the sun, the Schwarzschild radius is rather small. I think it's a few centimeters, right? Schwarzschild radius for the sun. That's the Earth. The sun is 4 kilometers, okay? But the orbit of Mercury is substantially bigger than 4 kilometers, so this correction is very small. So RS for M sun is 4 kilometers. So that's a small correction. Okay, so we're going to determine its effect in perturbation theory, and this small parameter will exactly be RS over R. Well, first of all, let's just sketch V of R. Okay, so V of R is this whole thing here. Whoops. Okay, so V of R. Well, at small r, V of R. At small r, which term dominates? At small r. Okay. Which term of the three? There are three terms in V of R. Which one is biggest at small r? The what?
Correction.
The correction, yeah. Correction is huge at small r, totally dominates. So we get minus 1 over r cubed, which looks like that. At large r, this term dominates, right? So at large r, you get minus 1 over r. And then the 1 over r squared, that's the positive term in the potential. That's a centrifugal barrier. And that, of course, goes like this. Okay, so usually Newtonian mechanics, we study a potential like this. But with the correction, it does that. Okay, and so that's the shape of the potential. And once you know the potential, the general solution is obvious. Okay, I just think of R as a particle moving in this potential. And so obviously it can sit in here and oscillate back and forward. That is the elliptical orbits that Newton discovered, where the radius changes periodically with time. But also, I could have these orbits, where you come in from infinity, and you bounce off the centrifugal barrier, and you go back out to infinity. Those are the unbound hyperbolic orbits in Newtonian mechanics. The new feature in GR is you have this attractive potential. And so two possibilities. I could have an orbit which sits exactly at the maximum and is circular, right, and just goes round and round. So in other words, there would be two circular orbits. There's one here where the radius doesn't change, and there's one here. So in GR, there are two circular orbits for fixed energy and J, actually not for fixed energy, for fixed J, where the potential only depends on J. The energy, of course, measures how high you are in this diagram. And then, of course, you can have these funny orbits where particles come out of the singularity at R equals zero and bounce off the potential and go back to R equals zero. Okay, all of these are allowed orbits. So, yeah.
Where on that graph is RS?
We're about to determine. I mean, it's in that function.
Okay. So, so that's V of R. Let us figure out where the circular orbits are at dv dr equals zero. Okay, just the maximum and the minimum. So if I differentiate the potential, what I get, this is rs over r squared minus 2j squared over r cubed plus 3rsj squared over r to the fourth. And this is a quadratic equation for r. Okay, obviously, if I multiply through by r to the fourth, I get r squared, r, and constant in this, in these terms. So the solution is r plus or minus. So we're going to call this one r plus and r minus, the two circular orbits. So r plus or minus is j over rs times 1 plus or minus square root of 1 minus 3rs squared over j squared. Okay, so as you adjust the angular momentum, the centrifugal barrier changes. And by the way, so does the Einstein correction. It depends on the angular momentum. So these features in the curve, the increase and the decrease, would get stronger as J increases. So what you see is let me see if there is a simple way of saying this. Well, just straight from the formula, what we see is that if to have real solutions, we must have J bigger than root 3 RS. What happens when we decrease J towards square root of 3 RS is that, of course, this curve will change shape, so the peak will go down. And as we decrease RS, it's going to do, as we decrease J, it's going to do this, and then it's going to go flat. And when it goes flat, this is when J equals root 3 RS. Okay, so you can just think of that as being there's not enough angular momentum to stop you falling into the black hole, right? If there's no angular momentum, you're just going to go radially straight into the black hole, and that's what's happening. Now, there is something called the innermost stable circular orbit. We're not really interested. By the way, which of these orbits is stable and which is unstable? That's fairly obvious. This guy is unstable, right? So some small deviation, it will fall off the hill. This one is stable. So we're not really interested in unstable orbits. They would be completely unusual. to find physically. Wouldn't expect a particle to survive in an unstable orbit for long. But so we're interested in the stable orbit, and we're interested in just how far can it go inwards, right, and still exist. So how far in, if we did compress the sun into a black hole of a size 4 kilometers, radius 4 kilometers, how near can we send Mercury, and pretend Mercury is a point mass, how near can we send Mercury to this 4 kilometer black hole before it falls in? Okay, and that is the innermost stable circular orbit. In GR jargon, it's called ISCO, the ISCO. And obviously, that's when J equals root 3 RS. So if I plug that into this formula, now let's see, my dimensions must have gone wrong. Sorry, there's a J squared here. All I do is put in J equals root 3 RS. The square root goes away. This becomes a factor of 3. So that is at R ISCO, and that's equal to 3 RS. Okay, so the innermost stable orbit, if this is RS, the innermost stable orbit is a factor of 3 times bigger in radius. Okay, so if you tried to put Mercury any closer to the black hole than that, and tried to keep it in a stable circular orbit, you can't. It will just fall in. So when people like Avery Broderick do observations of black holes, this is exactly what they're going to test. You've got this cloud of gas going around the black hole. There's 4 million solar mass black hole there. And they want to check that the gas will be depleted up to this ISCO. Now, Einstein, of course, did more than this. He actually solved for the trajectory. So let's do that now. Let's do that over here. To find the trajectory in the regime where the GR corrections are small, i.e. are much bigger than RS, we do the following. Actually, what we do is we follow Newton. And what Newton realized is that rather than solving for R of tau, or t, the time, it's easier to solve for R as a function of angle. We define R of phi. Of course, that's what we're interested in, is the shape of the orbit. We're not going to actually, we don't really care about following it in time if we want the shape. So let's consider R as a function of phi, and then calculate the R prime, which by definition is dr d phi. And so to get that, I divide R dot by phi dot, and use the conservation law for phi, for angular momentum, rather. So I get r dot r squared over j. And then the equation, this equation, star becomes j squared r prime squared over r to the fourth minus rs over r plus j squared over r squared. 1 minus rs over r equals constant. So we've gained a few powers of r. And it still looks a little ugly. But now the trick, actually, I'm not sure whose trick this was. Probably Newton, but it may have been somebody a bit later. The trick is to notice that if I define u to be 1 over r, then this equation is a harmonic oscillator for Newtonian mechanics. Okay, and this is a correction. But to see that, if u is 1 over r, then u prime is r prime over r squared. So this is u prime squared. This is u, so that's linear. This is u squared, so that's the harmonic oscillator. And this is u cubed. So it makes sense to use this variable. And then what we get is that u prime squared minus rs over j squared u plus u squared minus rs u cubed equals constant. And this is just a simple harmonic oscillator. To study it, what we do, the presence of the linear term just means the minimum is shifted by a constant. So we rewrite it as u prime squared plus u minus rs over 2j squared, all squared. That will reproduce the u squared term and this term from the cross term here. And of course, with a constant, which we can ignore, it's just part of the constant, minus rs u cubed equals constant. OK, so here we have the simple harmonic oscillator. And everyone knows the solution of the simple harmonic oscillator. So we treat the last term as a perturbation. So we will write u equals u0, the zeroth order solution, which solves the simple harmonic oscillator, and then plus u1, which is of order rs over r, rs over r. So the first, so I solve for this variable, just the shifted u is a simple harmonic oscillator. So it follows that u of 0 is equal to rs over 2j squared times 1 plus e cos phi. That's just saying that harmonic oscillator, the shifted harmonic oscillator, is u minus this constant, is just equal to a constant times cos phi, right? That's the solution of harmonic oscillator. It's u double dot is minus u. The solution is cosine or sine. We're not going to care about the particular phase of the solution. So this is Newton's solution of the orbits of the planet because it's an equation for an ellipse. Okay, so this means that r equals 2j squared over rs, 1 plus e cos phi. Because r is just 1 over u. I guess it goes this way. And now we want to solve for u1, the first order perturbation. So I put the u1 into, well, let's first of all work out the equation of motion. So let's call this dagger. So to get u1, we just differentiate dagger. to get the equation of motion for u, and what we have is u double prime is equal to minus u minus rs over 2j squared plus 3 halves. I get a 3 from differentiating the u up here with respect to phi, and then I drop the u prime. 3 halves rs u squared. So this is the perturbation. And now in perturbation theory, we're going to substitute in u0. U0, of course, solves this equation. U0 solves this. And so it follows that u1 double prime should equal to minus u1. So just imagine everywhere I say a u, I put in u0 plus u1. Okay, so the remainder term is the u1 double prime, and over here I get the u1. The u0 is gone because it solved this equation. And then over here, I've got to put in the u0 because this is my small parameter, 3 halves rs u0 squared. Okay, if I wanted to work it to second order, then the second order perturbation would be determined in terms of u0 times u1 and so on. But we're only going to first order. So what we have is minus u1. So it's just a driven harmonic oscillator, right? The first perturbation is harmonic oscillator. It's being driven by the zeroth order solution. The zeroth order solution involves cos phi. So we're driving this oscillator with this term, which we've already worked out. So it's 3 eighths rs cubed over j. So I'm just plugging in the u0 here, over here, right? So it's rs cubed over j to the fourth e cos phi. Okay, notice it depends on the ellipticity. If the ellipticity was zero, in other words, if the orbit is circular, there's no correction. Okay, to this order. So to lowest order, the correction depends on the ellipticity. Fortunately, Mercury's orbit is elliptical, and that ellipticity drives the Einsteinian correction. Now, to see what the solution is, okay, so I want to solve u double prime equals minus u plus this driving term. When you see that equation, you should immediately say, wow, we're going to get something interesting. Okay? Why? I'm driving a harmonic oscillator. Phi is the time, right? Phi is the time variable in this equation. I'm driving it with a force that depends on the time. And what's special about that force? Right, so I've got a harmonic oscillator, which is going back and forth, and I'm driving it with a force, which is positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative. What happens? Resonance. Thank you. Okay, so this gives a resonant driving force. Why is it resonant? Because this frequency is exactly the resonant, the frequency of the oscillator. Okay, so you're driving it on resonance. So as soon as Einstein derived this equation, he said, wow, I'm going to get a big effect. Okay, because my correction isn't going to stay small. It's going to be what we call secular. A secular correction is one which builds up over time. That's what happens in resonance. You do perturbation theory, and actually perturbation theory fails when you get these kind of corrections. So you get a secular growth, and actually that causes the breakdown of perturbation theory. So So I showed you some movies of shocks a couple of lectures ago. And the reason shocks form is exactly the same, that fluid dynamics is a nonlinear system. And generally, when you do perturbation theory, the perturbation expansion fails. And these shocks are the result. OK, so that's just words. But now you know what to expect. You can write down the solution. The solution is U1 equals. So just solve this differential equation. And then I claim that the solution is this, 3RS cubed over 8J to the fourth E, and then phi sine phi. OK, and that's what the resonance gives you. This is the secular growth. OK, so all you have to do is differentiate that guy twice, put it in the equation, and you'll see the remainder term is cosine. It's fairly obvious, because if I differentiate this twice, the phi twice, I'm going to get nothing, because it's linear. The only correction is coming from differentiating this once and this once, which will give me 1, and this will give me cosine phi, which is the term I want. OK, so so that's the solution. So the full solution is U equals RS over 2J squared, just the U0, 1 plus E cos phi, plus this secular growing term, E phi sine phi, plus dot, dot, dot. We only work to lowest order in RS, in the Schwarzschild radius. And now here comes the big step, which is to say, look, if this is a secularly growing term, my perturbation expansion is going to fail, because the second order correction is definitely going to become bigger than the first. Okay, but it's only going to fail slowly. Okay, so this term is growing slowly. So locally, I should be able to absorb this term in the first order term, right? Because there's really nothing much happening for small times. Nothing much is happening. It's only over long periods of time that this term becomes big compared to that. So can't you remove that term by correcting the zeroth order? And yes, you can. It's easy to correct it. This is approximately R over 2J squared, 1 plus E cosine 1 minus epsilon phi, okay, where epsilon is 3RS squared over 4J squared. So you can see this is true, because if I expand this as a Taylor series in epsilon, then at epsilon equals 0, I get the first term. And at linear order in epsilon, I get the correction, which is epsilon phi times the derivative of the cosine, which will give me the sine phi. OK, and of course, because the derivative of cosine gives minus phi, that's why I picked the minus sine phi. I picked the minus epsilon in order to get the right sine here. So this is actually a resummation of perturbation theory to remove secular term. So what we see is that this effect of this growing perturbation is nothing but a change in the period of the orbit, right? So as phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, Newton's orbit was periodic in the sense that the radius comes back to exactly what it was as the angle goes once around. Einstein's orbit does not. Phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, and the radius isn't the same. Okay, so instead, so Newton gives you this, an ellipse. You come back to exactly the same radius when you go around once. This is phi, of course. But Einstein, in order to get to the same radius, you have to go further in angle, because it's a negative number. So I need to go to 2 pi times 1 plus epsilon to get to the same radius. So Einstein, you come back to a smaller radius, and so on. Oops. Okay, so this movement, this is called a precession of the perihelion. Okay, the perihelion is the, I hope that's the right terminology. I never remember aphelion and perihelion. Anyway, the perihelion, I think, is the furthest point away from the sun. And, pardon? The perihelion is the closest? Okay, well, let's rename it the aphelion, because I think it's much more intuitive to think about the furthest point precessing than the nearest one. But of course, they both precess. The perihelion is when this guy is, I guess, when the cosine is minus 1, and the aphelion when it's plus 1. But it's I would picture it much more easily to, you know, to say that it moves around like this. So for historical reasons, people call it the precession of the perihelion. Okay. So this agrees to first order in epsilon. Epsilon is a dimensionless number, obviously, so that's a good expansion parameter. But about the second expression does not have secular growth. And so the expansion does not fail in this form. So Einstein figured this out, and the change in phi, which is this angle, the angle that the aphelion moves per orbit, is equal to so phi must go to 2 pi 1 plus epsilon in order for the cosine to go back to 1. And so the change in phi is 2 pi epsilon. And so this is equal to 3 pi rs squared over 2 j squared. And this turns out to be equal to 43 arc seconds per century. It's a very small effect for Mercury, which, so a century consists for Mercury of 415 orbits. So I guess, well, it's not really equals. This is the delta phi per orbit. Okay, so this guy is equal to 415 delta phi. So this tiny, tiny angle had actually been detected already before Einstein's theory. And it was known in the 19th century that something was a bit wrong with the orbit of Mercury. And I guess, and I think, most people thought maybe this is an indication the sun has a quadrupole moment, and this is kind of dragging the orbit of Mercury around with it a little bit. And then, in fact, in the 1960s, Bob Dickey, who was a real pioneer of GR in the 60s, a sort of renaissance of GR in the 60s, and, of course, a discoverer of the microwave background, well, theoretical discoverer. The experimentalists were Penzias and Wilson, but Bob Dickey sort of knew it should be there and was about to discover it if Penzias and Wilson hadn't. Anyway, Bob Dickey, being a skeptic by nature, tried to really scrutinize Einstein's theory of relativity, and so he revived this theory that the quadrupole moment was responsible. And they made much more precise measurements in the 60s and eventually excluded that. So it wasn't really until the 1960s that this became quite solid. But yeah, absolutely amazing prediction. No free parameters, right, at all. And it says Newton was wrong, and the orbits are not ellipses. They precess. So absolutely remarkable. So I think when Einstein realized that his formula agreed with this ancient anomaly, or decades-old anomaly in astronomy, he figured, oh, maybe I'm on the right track. That was the most important, well, apart from the equality of gravitational inertial mass, which dated back to Galileo, this was the biggest clue that GR was correct. So while we're thinking about particles orbiting masses, let's quickly consider the bending of light. Okay, so in this case, we're not going to have a, yeah. Sure. How do you calculate J? How is J defined? True. J is a free parameter, I would say, which is, I would say you just treat J as a parameter which you use to fit the orbit. Okay, so this expression here will exactly agree with Newton. Okay, the leading term exactly agrees with Newton. So if you do Newtonian mechanics, RS is, of course, 2GM. So this guy is over J squared. And in Newtonian mechanics, J is, of course, the angular momentum per unit mass. So this will just be R squared phi dot, d phi dt. So this is Newton's version. Okay, these agree exactly. And so I think it's safe to simply fit J to the Newtonian result and substitute it back and predict this equation. So that's the definition of J. You just measure this in the Newtonian sense at lowest order and plug it back into that formula. Okay, so J, of course, receives corrections in the due to relativity, but the velocity of Mercury is way smaller than the speed of light. So this is approximately R squared d phi d tau. So there's some correction. But that correction in here will be multiplied by a small number, which is the RS, so you can ignore it. So the bending of light was different because Newton had predicted bending of light. Newton thought light was a particle, right? And he thought light is a particle that moves at some speed. That was certainly the obvious thing. Later, people measured the speed of light. They measured it very early in the, I believe, in at least the 18th century, if not the 17th century, the speed of light was measured. But from astronomical observations. And so people assumed light is just a particle and it moves at this particular speed. And then it's trivial in Newton's theory to work out how light is bent. Okay, so light, so here we have the sun. We have some background star, and not to scale. We have the Earth with the observer on it. And we detect the light coming past the sun. And of course, even in Newton's theory, the light would be bent. And so this is what Newton would say. Just the gravitational attraction of the sun would bend the light. So it's obviously very important for Einstein to calculate the bending of light and see if he agreed with Newton's prediction. At that time, the bending of light was not measured. Nobody had attempted to measure, a very, very difficult measurement because it's small. So Einstein calculated the bending of light. So let us do that now. So this is Newton's prediction, and I'll tell you the relative predictions in a moment. Right. So actually very easy from what we've done, because we've already done everything we need to do. We just need to, what do we need to do? There's one term we can delete. Of course, for the bending of light, all we have is g mu nu x dot nu equals 0 for light. That's the only difference. Okay? So tell me immediately which term in the potential is not there for light. Everything is the same except one term. You've got to remember a little bit of the algebra. So you see, I started here with the massive particle, and then I multiplied by 1 minus rs over r. Right? So which term is not there for the massive particle? Remember, the top equation, we multiply by 1 minus rs over r. We got an rs over r term on the right-hand side. We brought it back to the left-hand side. Here it is. Okay? That term's not there for a massless particle. So there's no minus 1 over r term for Einstein. Otherwise, we have all the same terms. And so let's just mentally go up there, delete the rs over r term, and then what we see is we get u prime squared. So again, I'm just going to work it out as a function of phi. U prime squared plus u squared, right? So I take the third line down here and remove that u term, because the u term came from the 1 over r. So u prime squared plus u squared minus RSU cubed equals constant. So it's quite different than Newton. You know, Newton, you have the 1 over r potential. In Einstein, that's gone, right? Nevertheless, we'll get a bending of light.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't matter that much, but the e squared minus 1, that minus 1...
Doesn't matter at all. It's all in the constant. Yeah. Doesn't matter at all. The e squared doesn't matter. Okay. So let us again solve this first. Okay. This is the zeroth order in RS over R. This term is down by RS over R compared to that term. So we solve this first, and then we infer the influence of this term upon the final solution. So this is U0. And again, it's just a harmonic oscillator. The only difference is we don't have the 1. It's not a shifted harmonic oscillator. It's just a harmonic oscillator. So U0 is 1 over B sine phi. I could have chosen a cosine. The phi, it makes the geometry a little clearer. Let's interpret this. Well, of course, that's 1 over the radius, 0. So we're saying that the radius of phi is equal to B over sine phi. So, anyone know what that's an equation for? It's an equation. It's a parametric equation for a shape. What is the shape? What's the simplest shape you know? A straight line. Okay, so here is phi. Here is R. Here is B. And so clearly R over B is, or B over R is sine phi, right? So that's what this equation says. So this is just a straight line. So it makes perfect sense. At zeroth order, particle of light just goes straight past the sun in a straight line. So now we look at this equation. What we'll do is exactly what we did before. Differentiate it with respect to phi, d by d phi, and divide by u prime. And what I'm going to get is u double prime equals minus u. That's from these two terms. And then from this one, I will get plus 3 u squared rs, plus 3 rs u squared. Three halves, right? Because when I differentiate that, I get u prime u. I get a factor of 2, u prime, u double prime, plus u, and then I get minus 3 rs u squared u prime equals 0, and I drop the u primes. Okay, so now I can solve it because u is sine phi, and so I just have to, u0 is sine phi, so u1 is going to be driven by that solution. We're not on resonance anymore. The sine phi squared is going to give cos 2 phi and a constant. And those do not drive the solution on resonance. The resonant frequency is 1. And so we just have to solve this equation. And then you can check that the solution is 1 over b sine phi, the zeroth order solution, plus 3 quarters rs over b squared times 1 plus 1 third cosine 2 phi plus higher order. And the higher order just means in rs over r. And so now we can read off what the bent line looks like, because to get the shape of the line, we just look at r, as r goes to infinity, u goes to 0, right? So I just want to solve u equals 0 and determine phi. So there are two solutions. If I just take the first term, there are two values of phi for which u is 0. What are those two values? I'm setting u equal, r is infinity, right? So if I set u equals 0, what are the two solutions for phi? Sine phi is 0, so what are the two solutions? Just look at the diagram. Phi equals 0, and phi equals pi. Okay, as the particle comes past the sun, actually I drew it, I should have put the star here and us over there. So the particle is initially at phi equals 0, and then it comes past the sun, and it's at phi equals pi. So phi equals 0, and phi equals pi. So in the zeroth order solution. The first order solution, all I have to do is take the right-hand side and set it equal to 0 using the zeroth order solution. Okay, so I say phi is equal to phi 0 plus phi 1, the correction. Let's call it phi infinity. And I set u equals 0. And let's assume this guy is small. If phi is equal to 0 plus phi 1 infinity, then this equation, dagger with u equals 0 becomes, or dagger, I just say u equals 0, is this guy 1 over b. If phi 1 is small, sine phi is just phi. And then this term, I'm allowed to use the zeroth order value for phi, which is 3 quarters rs squared over, rs over b squared times phi equals 0, which is 4 thirds. Okay, so phi 1 infinity is minus rs over b. That's all. So what it's saying is that here is my line. This is phi. This is r. As I go off to infinity, I'm going to asymptotically go to this negative value of phi. So this is phi 1 infinity. Okay, and if we say phi is pi plus phi 1 infinity, then of course what happens is this sine, if you plot sine, sine goes to 0 at 0 and pi. This is sine phi against phi. We want the sine to be slightly negative. So it's saying that the angle has to be slightly less than 0 or slightly bigger than pi. And so we will get phi 1 infinity equal to plus rs over b. And basically, that's just saying the orbit goes off in that direction. And the angle here is phi 1 infinity, which is positive in that case. OK, so you get the total deflection angle. Angle is just twice rs over b. And that's in radians. Let's put it over there. Total deflection angle in radians is 2rs over b. And so that's equal to 4gm over b. B is the impact parameter. It's the distance of closest approach of the light ray to the sun times c squared. And so b equals the impact parameter. And the bigger, the closer you are to the sun, the bigger the deflection angle. So your best hope of seeing this is to use for b the radius of the sun.
Neil?
Mm-hmm.
But the impact parameter is the distance that I would have had if it wasn't deflected. So it's going to be bigger than the minimal distance. And that's the minimal distance, and the impact parameter I calculated with one of the branches to infinity.
No. When you compute the, let's see where the particle is when phi takes this angle.
Oh, no, yeah, but that's the closest. But I think that the impact parameter, we use it to describe, I think, other.
No, just look at this formula. This is the shape of the orbit, right? Mm-hmm. So at phi equals pi over 2, 1 over r is 1 over b. That's telling you the radius is the impact parameter, plus a small correction. We're not going to measure the small correction.
No.
So the radius of closest approach, you're correct, is not exactly b. It's b corrected with a relativistic correction, which is tiny. So just ignore it. It's unmeasurable.
I want to give
you another. Oh. What were you meaning?
That if I go to one of the branches,
yes,
that is going to be a straight line.
Yes.
And I continue it.
Oh, yes. True, but...
And I call that distance the impact parameter.
I see what you mean. Yeah, I think formally you're correct. That if I'm an experimentalist trying to set up an impact, yeah, okay, yeah, I think you're right. Let's not call it the impact parameter. Let's call it b is approximately the radius of closest approach. So the radius of closest approach is when phi is pi over 2 and r, 1 over r, is 1 over b plus this thing, 3 quarters r s squared over b squared. Let's see, my dimensions don't look correct. Is there a cubes? Oh, sorry, it's just r s over b squared. And then phi is pi over 2, so that's 1 minus a third, which is 2/3. So I get 1/2 here. Okay. So this, of course, is equal to 1 over b times 1 plus 1/2 rs over b. And so then we can see that b is approximately, just invert this equation, b is 1 plus 1/2 rs over b times r. R is the distance of closest approach. R is the value of the radius when phi is pi over 2. Right? So phi was 0. And phi equals pi over 2. I just used that formula. And so b is this. So r closest. OK, and this is tiny. So this, of course, is approximately 1 plus 1/2 rs over r closest. Times r closest. In fact, we can just work that out, can't we? So it's r closest approach plus 1/2 rs. So b is the distance of closest approach plus 1/2 the Schwarzschild radius. So it's not the radius of the sun, it's the radius of the sun plus 4 kilometers. Okay, that's what b is. Okay, so for the sun, if we take the radius of closest approach, the So for the sun, we get 1.75, so delta phi total. The total deflection angle is 4gm sun over radius of the sun times c squared, and this is 1.75 arc seconds. So that's an extremely tiny angle. Remember, there are 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in a degree. And so this is it's less than 1/1000th of a degree. And so this was a challenge to measure. Einstein predicted this, I believe, in 1917, something like that, maybe 1915, somewhere around that. In fact, it's kind of amusing because his first paper on this, he got the wrong answer. He got the answer wrong by a factor of 2. But fortunately, he found the error. The error wasn't so much algebra, it was conceptual, that he, you know, in the Schwarzschild metric, there's a term multiplying the t, the dt squared, and that's the Newtonian potential used for non-relativistic particle orbits. So he could infer what that potential was. And what he did is he forgot about the 1 minus rs over r multiplying the dr squared, basically because he didn't know how to get it. He didn't have any equations which determined the spatial components of the metric because he didn't yet have the Einstein equations. And so he just used the 0,0 part of the metric. This was before the equations of gr. And he got half of this angle. So he agreed with Newton's result. Fortunately, he corrected that, got the factor of 4. If you work through the algebra, you'll find that a half of this comes from the TT component and a half comes from the RR component. And that's why you get the factor of 2. So he made this prediction. And then in 1919, the British Astronomer Royal, who's a very grand appointment in Britain, or used to be, the Astronomer Royal and Arthur Eddington, who was one of the very few people who understood Einstein's theory at that time. And he wrote a beautiful book called The Mathematical Theory of Relativity in the early 1920s, which actually is extremely clear and a wonderful book. Anyway, those two people, the Astronomer Royal and Arthur Eddington, went to a small island called Principe off West Africa. I think it's off Guinea. And they went there to observe a solar eclipse. So there was a solar eclipse traveling across the surface of the Earth, and they waited on Principe for the eclipse. And so what they saw is the sun almost perfectly covered by the moon, and that blacked out the sun. And then just on the edge, they observed the position of a star in the sky, and they took a photograph, and then they waited for the sun to become clear again, or the sun to move out of the picture, took another photograph, and then figured out the relative deflection of the star in angle by looking at the two photographs. And you'll find their paper online. It's very, very amusing. It includes a description of how they got what they called native bearers to carry their equipment and how everything failed. And there was a tropical rainstorm, and it's all in their paper. But finally, they got some results. And they got this within about 10% error. So it was enough to conclusively rule out Newton's theory and confirm Einstein's theory. And overnight, Einstein went from being unknown outside of physics to being a global celebrity. And the front of the New York Times and all that said, Newton is dead. Okay? This was the calculation which did it. So just an absolutely wonderful history. So I think tomorrow we're going to fall into the black hole, and then we will discover another universe, and we'll also discover a white hole and all sorts of bizarre and wonderful features about GR. And I think that is unfortunately all we'll have time for. So any questions on this?
Yeah, that was fun.
Okay, good, thank you. It is fun, isn't it? It's just amazing.